always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Investigators are looking into the background of the man they say killed two employees of the Israeli embassy in Washington, the FBI Stephen Jensen.
We are aware of some writings that are purported to have been authored by this subject. We're actively investigating to determine both the authorship and the attribution of these writings.
At least three people have died in the crash of a small private jet into a Navy neighborhood in San Diego early this morning. CBS's Carter Evans is on the scene.
You can still smell the jet fuel in the air. About 100 people were evacuated, and many who fled the flames won't be able to go back home until the NTSB completes its initial investigation.
The narrowly approved House budget bill bars Medicaid payments to health centers that provide abortions. Planned Parenthood's Katie Rodahan.
These lawmakers are willing to sacrifice affordable health care for people across the country because of their opposition to abortion.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Hi, this is Beth, host of The Kitchen's Open. Join us each Monday morning at the top of the 10 o'clock hour for tips, tricks, and a whole lot of fun. The Kitchen's Open, only on WFHR.
The Brewers in a rain delay. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Steady showers in Pittsburgh forced a rain delay tonight for the Brewers against the Pirates. Milwaukee was up 5-3, thanks in part to a three-run home run by Christian Yelich before the umpires called for the tarp to be pulled out with two outs in the bottom of the sixth. NFL, Jordan Love playing softball tomorrow night. It's the annual Packers Celebrity Softball Game for charity at the Timber Rattlers Stadium in Grand Chute, Wisconsin. Matt LaFleur on the FanDuel Network was asked, how many years now has he been in Green Bay?
It's year seven. I was talking with one of the vets, and it's incredible to how fast this has really gone. You know, I mean, shoot, Jordan and I were talking the other day. He's going year six, so it's pretty incredible. It flies by, but that's why it's so important to stay present and try to maximize our time together. And you know, we got to do whatever we can to win as many games as possible.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Sports allow us to play, learn, and grow. But there's something more important than victory. At the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, we believe every athlete deserves to be safe. Safe from abuse and misconduct on and off the field. We equip athletes, parents, coaches, and others with the right education to recognize, prevent, and respond to harmful behavior. Join the movement to champion respect and end abuse at uscenterforsafesport.org.
Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Again, the Medicaid cuts, front and center. In fact, my email box has been filled with nothing, honestly, but horror stories of people saying, hey, I'm terrified for myself, for my children, for my parents, for our loved ones, for our neighbors. I'm terrified of what's going on and what's going to happen to all these people who we now know are dependent on this program. And, you know, as I was sitting here before the show started, my mind's going in all these places. You know, there's all of these stories and all of this heartbreak of, you know, people with their children born with birth defects, loved ones who have had illnesses that have come on, injuries, you know, all kinds of things that happen to everyday people, to working people. And this little bit of a safety net is now being ripped away. And I couldn't help but sit and think of all of these stories and what you would do in those situations. And here's the part that was most heartbreaking. Because, you know, I think I put myself in with this group now, given the situation with my wife. As you know, back in September of last year, she was hit by a careless driver while riding her motorcycle. And now she's never going to be the person she was. She may never, we're still hopeful, but she may never be independent. She may always need someone. And, you know, we're not a very big family. Something happens to me, something happens to you know, one of our children. We're in trouble. Right now, we're very fortunate that we have means, we have the ability to manage things. But down the road, what happens to her? And I think about this. Without this safety net, I'm paralyzed by the possible. And I think about the people who right now are where I fear I may someday be. I've always said, and this is one of those things that, little insight into me, and I rarely talk about my intimate family issues. But, one of the reasons that I've always worked 70 plus hours a week throughout my whole working life is I remember my mother looking at me and with tears in her eyes, knowing that there was nothing she could do, knowing that I was hungry or bad things were happening, and there was nothing she could do, nothing. And I've always worked to ensure that I'm never in that situation, and currently we're not. But the stories that people are sharing with me are people who are in that situation, who are looking at their loved one and saying, I might not be able to help. Our children who have a birth defect or childhood illness, type 1 diabetes keeps coming up. I might not be able to take care of you. You may die because of my inability to get you the health care that you desperately need. Or as children looking at their parents going, I can't take care of mom or dad. They need real skilled nursing facilities and skilled care, well above my ability and our financial ability to take on. All of these stories that are just piling up, and a Congress that seems flippant at best, evil at worst. The fact that we're going to pull all of this resource out of this Medicaid program, which is the bottom, the bedrock, the bottom of our safety net. To where when bad things happen, at least something is helpful. And it's, to be honest, one of the things that I'm struggling with is since this has happened, everyone you deal with from hospitals and doctors to contractors who you need to do work or whatever, everyone's got their hand out. Everything costs. And it's not cheap. Everything's expensive. The only people who have said, hey, how can we help without there being a, write us a check, oddly enough, has been the government. The Medicaid people who have come and helped us navigate some of the system, they're the folks who have come in and said, hey, what do you need? That's what it's supposed to do. And what's happening, and again, it's this push towards privatization. It's this push toward destroying government, making it so small that Grover Norquist can drag it into the bathtub and drown it. This is not good. And while there are millions of families not sleeping well tonight, you've got people in Congress who are thinking, hey, how can we save money by taking care away from people who desperately need it? And this idea, no, we're just looking at waste, fraud, and abuse. You mean like paying nursing homes not to send people to hospitals so that they die earlier? You mean that? I'm telling you, right now, if you haven't acted, it's time to stand up, speak out. And what I'm telling each one of these people who emails me, and thank you, please keep sending emails, rick@thericksmithshow.com, is tell everyone, your local newspaper, your politician, everyone, do not go quietly. As though the Adapt woman told me, if I'm going to die, they're going to watch me do it right here. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the reality is these Medicaid cuts are going to be horrible. The emails I've been getting from folks, heartbreaking. And I don't think, again, the Republicans haven't done any town halls that we can speak of to where the stories that I'm hearing, to people that are reaching out to me, have an opportunity to look these people in the face and go, hey, you're killing me. You're harming my family. You're harming us. They're hiding from that. But my good friend Alex Lawson found one of those representatives, Iowa Republican Miller Meeks, who was running from the vote. My friend Alex caught her in the hallway and asked some questions that I thought, well, pretty interesting. Here's the clip.
Congresswoman, I was wondering if you would just talk to us on your way over to the conference meeting?
No.
Last time you spoke with us, you lied to our face and said that you weren't going to vote for Medicaid cuts. But then you've actually voted for the largest cuts to Medicaid in the history of the country. Do you have any comments on that? Do you have any comments on the four hospitals in your district that are going to close because of your vote? Representative Miller Meeks, I'm wondering if you have any comment on the health care that 67,000 people in your district are going to lose. Does it concern you that you only won by 800 votes?
You won by 800 votes. But here's the thing. 67,000 people in her district are going to lose health care. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what we didn't see in the video with Representative Miller Meeks and what that vote's going to mean, not just for the folks in Iowa, but the folks across the entire country. So I've asked my good friend Alex Lawson to come share some thoughts. He's executive director of Social Security Works. You can check out their website, socialsecurityworks.org. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Good on you. Good on you for getting into these people's face since they're running from their constituents like cowards. No town halls. Now remember, these are the people who are beating up on Democrats for not doing enough. These are people who are deliberately running, so good on you.
Thank you. One thing you didn't see is immediately following that, me and the cameraman, my producer, Pete, ran down six flights of stairs as quickly as possible to try to get her at the bottom of the elevator. But I think she went out on the first floor, or we were too slow.
Well, you're getting up in age. You're getting a little up in age.
I know. That's what I was judging myself, huffing and puffing at the bottom of the stairs, being like sort of thankful I didn't catch her because I don't think I could have really mustered up another question. No, I would have gotten something. Look, Rick, the truth is that I feel the same way as a lot of like the listeners that you in your setup. Like I'm so frustrated that the Republicans are planning literally. One of the most evil things that I've seen Washington, D.C. perpetrate on its own U.S. Citizens and residents, people who live here, because it will affect everybody in this country. Rural hospitals are going to close en masse. And so there's some people who are like, oh, well, I don't live in a rural area. You cannot lose the rural health infrastructure and then think that your, maybe suburban hospital is not going to be affected. These are systems. They're linked. We have all the data to show this. And we're in the middle of a rural healthcare collapse right now because of Medicare Advantage, privatized Medicare. And, you know, we were that's a red light flashing right now. You kick Medicaid out from under them, and it's not just Medicaid, but just the Medicaid, rural health care collapse. It's also ACA. You're also talking now about Medicare. You're talking about veterans' health and benefits. You're talking about what the Social Security benefits service disruptions. Like, this is catastrophic stuff for the American people. And these Republicans just hide. And when they do go on TV, they just lie. They're like, I'm not cutting Medicaid. I don't know what you mean. You know, they call the five factions in the House the five families.
Right.
And I think that's really apt because, like, that's how they operate, like a crime family or a criminal operation. You know, I got nothing to say as they're doing the dirty. So it was really fun to catch up with Representative Miller Meeks, who I think is in one of the most, like, this should just highlight who they are. She won by 800 votes. It was the closest race in the cycle. She's in Iowa's first congressional district. That's basically Iowa City surrounded by rural counties. There are hospitals in each of the rural counties. Every one of them is likely to close because of what she has already voted for and what she will vote for. And so it was deeply satisfying to be able to grill her. And all I did, Rick, was just asked for comment on the things that she is voting for.
Right.
And she got so scared to tell the truth that she ran away as fast as she could.
No, I mean, you simply said, this is what you did. Can you tell us why? And elections are going to have consequences, and the hope is that those 67,000 who unfortunately may lose health care, maybe this motivates them to vote for someone else, for anyone else. Because, you know, I've been saying this for a while, and you and I have had this back and forth, and I'm going, look, you know, bad things are going to happen. And it's people like Miller Meeks who are going to make sure that that does happen. But it's about now organizing those 67,000 people who are going to suffer, who are going to struggle, to get them to vote for someone else to come with what we actually need more of, which is an expansion of something like Medicaid. Or in my view, you know, scrap the whole thing and get me Medicare for all.
Well, you know, I agree with you there. It's so obvious. Save money and provide healthcare, not be the laughingstock of the developed economies and the single country in our peer nations who can't deliver healthcare as a right to all of our citizens, to all of our residents. Every other country, much poorer than we are, does it. And, you know, we in America are just willing to accept these billionaires saying, you're going to die early so that I can be richer than anyone has been in the history of humanity.
Yeah.
You're going to die early, because that's what small deviations, my MO. But those articles that are like, the French live longer than Americans. Why is that? And then they list all those. Is it because they smoke cigarettes and go on long walks? And they're like, the Italians live longer, right? And it's just one country after another. And you're like, it's because they have health care, people. That's why they live longer than us. They have health care. We don't have health care. And then the littlest bit that we do have, they're now ripping it away from the people who can least afford to lose that health care. And then finally, when they say it's like, you know, they're like, oh, well, people are living high on the hog on this government. It's health care. You know this, Rick. You can't spend health care on pizza so that you can play video games on the couch.
Yeah, but here's healthcare. The thing. And this is the interesting thing, because I've actually had this conversation recently. I know people who are hardworking people, blue collar, working class folks who don't get health care through their employer, or what they do get is horrible and just weak and not even almost not worth the card. But they go, hey, you know, you got these poor people. They get whatever they want when they need. I got to pay for it. So what the wealth class has done masterfully, and I go back to Jay Gould, man, I could pay half the working class to murder the other half. This is that on steroids.
It absolutely is. Or, you know, the crab mentality that, you know, in a boiling pot of water, if one crab is trying to climb out, the other crabs will grab it to climb out themselves and pull everyone in, and they all die together. And, you know, that's the billionaire class pointing every person that they can, the oldest trick of tyranny. Oh, it's their fault, right? And you're like, no, it's the billionaires' fault. It's the old people. It's the young people. It's immigrants. It's black people. It's white people. And you're like, no, it's rich people. That's who's doing it.
Absolutely. It's the greed class. And I'm glad you brought that up, because we're now seeing United Health Group being potentially investigated because of potential Medicare fraud. Now, you're the one who turned me on to this, that United Health Group could possibly be the replacement for Medicare, because, as I understand, they are the largest provider of Medicare Advantage plans, or disadvantage plans, however you want to look at that. So I look at this and I go, this should be a red light learning moment, that privatization of what little universal national kind of healthcare we have, probably not a great idea.
And just today, I'm sorry, time is an illusion right now in DC, today or yesterday, another fraud investigation. The Guardian broke this story. And this is stuff I might have even mentioned it on here. You know, we've been saying
this is
what they're doing.
Yep.
But they, it's just been exposed. They've been paying nursing homes. So they pay nursing homes basically not to bring people to the hospital, and so that United doesn't have to pay for it, and another payer can catch the bill if they're in the nursing home. This is a perverse incentive that exists in our system, where the payer in the nursing home is usually Medicaid, and then if it flips to the hospital, it would be either traditional or Medicare disadvantage. So United is paying them because it's cheaper, right? Like, obviously. And if you have no moral compass, just think of this. It's cheaper to pay them $1,000 per patient that they let die in a nursing home than it is to provide them care in a hospital. That's the system that privatized Medicare is. And, you know, we can sort of catch them now, and there might be some consequences to that. But the next iteration, they also own the nursing homes, right? Nursing homes have been all bought up by private equity. That is the how they do it. They'll just expand and own the nursing homes as well. And then they don't have to have a cash trail. They just won't transfer the patients who need the care to get the care. That's what private health insurance does. They will figure out who is sick, who might be sick, and deny them the care that they need. That's privatized Medicare. That's like, and it's super real that we could arrive at Medicare Advantage for all if we don't stop the metastasizing, the growth of Medicare Advantage.
No, and there's also been numerous stories about how when they send a home health aide to your home, that they're upcoding what your ailments are so they can charge more. And they're also doing a whole bunch of kind of spy work and reconnaissance work on your health so they know what they can either deny or cover. It's really, look, when the really smart people, when the bean counters get in there and they start going, hey, how can we squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams? It's not good for us. It's not good for us as patients or citizens or taxpayers or any of that, unless we're shareholders. And most of us aren't.
Yeah, bravo. That's exactly right, Rick.
No, but look, they do this with, look, you know, I think about in my lifetime, In my lifetime, most hospitals were community nonprofit health hospitals paid for by the local communities. It was part of the commons of what we did for ourselves. It was like how we provided ourselves water and sewer and parking and prisons. And you go down the list of all the things that we used to do for ourselves that we've now handed over to Wall Street or vulture capitalists or the whiz kids coming out of Harvard or wherever. Because, hey, we can squeeze that quarter until the eagle screams. And I get to keep all the profits, and we don't tax them. Whereas at least in the past, you had a 92% tax rate. Go on, go screw things up. We're just going to take it back and reinvest it. We're not even doing that.
That's exactly right. And I mean, like, I don't want to go too far into the tax policy that I get myself in trouble. But what you just said is the entire problem. Because we don't tax Wall Street, Private equity just means an enormous pile of cash, right? Because we don't tax it, those piles of cash just sit around looking for somewhere to go.
Yep.
And they purchase everything because it does not make sense to do anything else with it. There's so much money on the sidelines because, again, this is the part that so many people have a hard time believing. The United States of America is the richest country in the history of the world. But because it's generally accumulated in so few people's hands, people look around at the state of things and they're like, nah, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. It's true. And a huge problem is we don't tax capital enough. So capital, the return on capital, so far exceeds the return on labor that basically it's like you can blame it. But, you know, in your story, you were saying it's like the seller, you know, the hospital selling is sort of the agent of change, right? The person like, oh, I'm going to sell out to Wall Street. We've flipped about a decade ago from that to something totally different, which is these private equity. They just are hovering above everything. And whether you want to or not, they'll purchase what you've got, right? If you're a doctor's practice, they'll buy you. You don't get a say in it. And they have so much money and it's so hard to regulate that there's really no way to stop it except for getting our tax system back to a place that makes sense where you tax this money at a rate that says, use it for productive purposes or it's coming back.
Yeah. No, look, you know, when I tell people the top marginal tax rate during the Eisenhower, during the Kennedy, during the, you know, Johnson, during the Ford, Nixon, Ford, even up to Carter years, when that tax rate was 92% and then down to 70 after JFK, the corporate tax rate in the 50s and 60s was 56%. We paid a lot of tax, a lot more. And by T idiots, we're taxed enough already. No, we were much more taxed, but we also didn't have education that was so far out of hand, healthcare that was so far out of reach, all of the problems that we're now living. What we're now suffering from and coming to the final head of is my entire lifetime, we're told we're going to give the smart people the money because they know what to do with it. We're going to give these tax cuts. They're smart. It'll trickle down, Alex. It'll come trickling down like rivers of gold and honey. And what the reality is smart people do know what to do with the money. They make more money for themselves off our backs. And now we're finally coming to the reality of we're at the end of the road. This is it. This is the end of the road.
It is the end of the road. There's so many indicators that this is like the final stage of this extractive capitalism, which is a transformation into authoritarian fascism of some sort, right? Once the extractive capitalism reaches a level, use United as the example again, once it, you know, they've sold us a lie for 30 years, like, oh, we've got the best healthcare in the world. And you would hear people say that back to you, you know, they're like, yeah, we'll go try to get healthcare in another country. You still hear a little bit of that, but mainly what you hear now is people are like, our healthcare sucks. Me or my family members or somebody has been impacted. And so I know that our healthcare sucks. And so that's happening in sector after sector where people are like, hey, this doesn't work for us anymore. But they're looking around and they're realizing that there is no alternative the whole thing has been gobbled up. It's a monopoly. Yep. And the last stage after that monopolization is to lock it in with the coercive force of government so that they can use political violence to say, we don't care what you think about your right to healthcare. You're going to take what United Healthcare says because we're telling you that that's all you can do. And if United Healthcare says you're going to die, guess what? You're ballast weight. You're useless people. You will die so that these rich people can afford another golden yacht. That's what the bill right now is, I think, maybe not the final, but certainly nearing the penultimate. Like, you can't squeeze the system too much more than this current tax scam, right? I mean, it's enormous.
No, and the hope is people are getting on the phones, calling their representatives, organizing around each other for the next election, because this is bad, and it's bad. But, Alex, I appreciate the thoughts, the input, and great work. Keep it up. Love your social media. Hope folks will check Social Security Works, socialsecurityworks.org, the website. Alex Lawson, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. What do you think? Are we at the end of that road? Do you see all of these privatization schemes lining the pockets of the few and basically emptying yours, even if you got pockets? Want to hear it? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids Home for Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear for tonight and cool with lows in the upper 30s. Mostly sunny for tomorrow, a high in the low 60s. And up into the mid-60s for the holiday weekend with more sun than clouds. A chance of rain Monday night and Tuesday. Right now it's 53.
In this month's edition of Masters of Mystery, a forensic psychologist who turns real-life experiences investigating crimes into chilling novels, and a grandmother who writes about gangsters, will join host Rob Young. Tune in to WFHR Sunday at 9 p.m. as true crime writer Frank Weber and gangster writer Betty Brandt Pasek talk about their experiences and perhaps divulge the secrets behind their devious plots.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I saw a scary kind of number. And it's one of those things that's meant to grab your attention. It's meant to push you in the direction of action. But I got this email. It said China currently has 5,500 flagged vessels in international commerce. And we here in the United States have a whopping, an enormous, kind of a threatening 80. Yeah, 80. That's it. 80. And it sounds problematic, doesn't it? And here to answer the question of, does it matter? Does it matter that we have 80 ships and they've got 5,500 when you're talking about international commerce and our supply chain? Should it matter? So I've asked Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you.
So am I getting this right? They've got 5,500 flagged international commerce vessels. We have a whopping 80.
Correct. That is fact check true.
How big is this universe? I mean, you know, are there 100,000 ships in the ocean doing international commerce? How big is this world?
Yeah, and this would be for the, you know, the big international kind of like shipping container kind of ships and what have you. No, I mean, China has most of them right now. And for the past 10 to 15 years, they have risen to the point where they have half the world's shipbuilding capacity. They're putting about, you know, in a good year for them, 1,500 new vessels in the water now every year, commercial vessels. They have, if you're looking at all the shipping firms, and of course, you've probably seen them in pictures and what have you, like Maersk and all of those, right, on the side. You know,
We saw the Tom Hanks movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, is that ship still missing? I can't. Well, at any rate, 70% of all the ships that are being ordered in the commercial space today are going to China now. Wow. And no matter kind of like which country is going to be operating them. And so and we are churning out a whopping like 5 ships a year or so.
Has it always been that way? I mean, yeah. Because look, most people don't know, don't care. It's not one of these things that we see on the evening news. How bad is this problem? And has it always been this way?
Yeah, people take it for granted as long as it's working.
Right.
You know, the United States had the largest shipbuilding capacity in the world. We built it up, obviously, during World War II in a hurry. And we maintained that through kind of like the late 1970s. And then it really nosedived because in the 1980s, Reagan dismantled the shipbuilding program that we had because all the shipyards used to get some federal incentive. And some people may say, well, why is the federal government giving money to the shipyards? And here's the answer. Everybody else does, right? All the other shipbuilding nations do. And if you want to build ships, you got to do it. Ships are expensive. They take a long time to churn out. And the ROI is not fast. And so the subsidy is like part of the game. In fact, you know, when nations were negotiating freer trade, they like left shipbuilding subsidies alone.
Right. No, because I got 3 words for it. Arsenal of democracy.
That's right.
It's the number one reason you subsidize and hang on to it. It's the reason I always say I'm a protectionist, and I wear that proudly. I'm not an isolationist. When I leave my house, I lock the door. There's no giant moat. There's no drawbridge, no giant border fence. But you got to protect some of your stuff to help you protect your stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And so what happened first, so Reagan takes this away. Japan and South Korea kept up their shipbuilding programs and they scaled up. And then China came along at the beginning of the 2000s, again, enabled by its entry into the World Trade System, made it, you know, in the 5-year plans, it's written, we want to dominate shipbuilding. And so they built all these shipyards with all this capacity and now they dominate. I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, you know, the United States is a rounding error, you know, in terms of our ship output, Rick, every year.
Well, I would argue our output of just about everything that's manufactured. And again, it wasn't always this way. And I always like to point to that bridge in Trenton, New Jersey, that's lit up at night that said, you know, Trenton makes the world takes. That's not true anymore. And it's not like we lost it in direct competition. It's not like we were fighting over who's got the best widget. We gave most of this away. And I would argue shipbuilding, as you said, during the Reagan years, they gave up on it.
Yeah, we did. And then I would say for the last 10 or 15 years, even if we wanted to build it up, it would be very difficult to do so, in part because China has developed like the perfect industrial subsidy feedback loop where the subsidized steel goes to the subsidized shipyards and their subsidized oil companies have to use the subsidized ships to move their product back and forth. And so they have like a perfect system that they've developed through state finance to build up a massive shipbuilding sector. And then, you know, again, sell them to the rest of the world. And so, you know, we could not make a ship in the United States for, you know, for even probably 3 or 4 times the amount that they produce a ship in.
They're making it for the cost of raw materials. And to kind of drive this home and why this matters to working people or, you know, all of us. Is in your testimony back in June, you pointed out that we were once a global leader in shipping and shipbuilding. Yeah. In fact, the employment in that sector, you said in your testimony, was 180,000 workers. How many people are doing that job today?
Oh, it's less than a third of that. Yeah, I mean, it's shrunk dramatically, and most of the shipyards that are still open that aren't doing military work, by the way, there's four that do exclusively military work. But most of the rest that are still open, and some of them have been completely closed, are basically doing repair work, right? They're just doing repair work on existing ships, and they're not building new ships. And so we have only a couple of shipyards nationwide that are manufacturing new ocean-going vessels in the United States. And so, you know, there is a plan to turn this around. But it is important, and we talked before, and I think that I want to underscore this. Like, we all take this for granted when it works, but you know, at some point in time, if Xi Jinping says, you know what, we want to, you know, weaponize our commercial fleets and not, you know, not ship goods to the United States, or we want to put pressure on other countries,
or we're taking Taiwan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. If we, a naval blockade of Taiwan, and then we're SOL, as they say, right? And so is the rest of the world too. And I think there's a realization that this is a problem, and that this also has spillover effects to military capabilities as well, because you know both the military and the commercial ships draw from the same supply chain, and it's really shrunk in the United States. And so we do. I mean, look, we're not going to be building as many ships as we did in the 1970s or in World War II. We don't need to. But we need to build some. And in fact, if we doubled the number of ships that we produce in a year, we'd basically be moving from 10 to 20 or from 7 to 15. So it's not it's something that's very, very achievable, and we'd want to build up from there. But we're starting from almost, you know, having to like reboot the whole industry in the United States.
Now, on Monday, I was talking about you know, China going after Taiwan and becoming much more muscular. And I had one of our mutual friends, Emily De La Bruyere, on the program talking about, you know, how backed up we are. And it's the story that this Air Force Brigadier General Doug Wickard had brought a whole bunch of civic leaders to Edwards Air Force Base, was warning them about how ill-prepared we are, and how, you know, even a government report is saying, look, the population, we the people, are not aware, prepared, anywhere close to ready for any disruptions in supplies or services, let alone what could come out of a conflict with China. And it's got me thinking that maybe we should be talking about this a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think, you know, it's one of those issues that people don't want to talk about, in part because from a political perspective, there is no easy solution at this point, right? It's going to take some sacrifice. It's going to take some resources. It's going to take some change in posture to bring it about. And if it was like a slam dunk easy thing to do, we'd have done a long time ago, right? Because politics takes care of the easy things, but not the hard things.
Right.
And, you know, and companies don't want to talk about this either, because they're like,
they're making short-term profits.
That's right. Let's serve our happy consumers with all the, you know, container ships coming in from China that we sell for the low prices, and our stockholders do great, and our consumers love buying stuff. And so what's not to like, right? You know, until, again, there's a disruption, until China decides to weaponize this, or, you know, or even worse, if we get into some sort of a real blockade or other sort of situation, and then we have just a paucity of shipbuilding capacity in the United States. And the last thing is, this used to be a very unionized sector. These were all excellent jobs.
Yep.
I mean, they were great jobs. And you that's what we need more of today. And so, you know, this isn't something that's nostalgic. Oh, let's bring back those big shipyards like they were. No, let's modernize them. And I mean, like it or not, we are going to have to use foreign technology. Like, the Koreans know how to build ships, and the Japanese do, we basically lost that muscle. And so it will take a little bit of investment like that in the United States and from Europe, too, to help scale this up. But I do. I want them investing in these shipyards so that they can convert back from repairing ships to making ships and, you know, hiring union workers and using steel.
American steel, hopefully. But here's the thing. And this is, I've been reading a lot of these stories of people going, well, you know, Americans just don't want those manufacturing jobs, Scott. They just don't want that dirty stuff. We're not that country anymore. We don't have enough manufacturing workers to fill the manufacturing jobs we have today. How can we do more? That's a narrative I keep running over. Is that true, you think?
Yeah, it's a convenient narrative because there are definitely cases where there are small and mid-sized manufacturers who have the help wanted sign out for a while and then are shocked when no one shows up. But these facilities, and I'm just going to lay it out there, like their wages, some of them are less than you can make in an Amazon warehouse, right? And, you know, and it takes more skills training, and they expect the workers to come, you know, skilled up. And the shifts are not as flexible as you're going to get, right, in some other places, because production work requires you to be there in person and you have to be there as a team to do it. And so it's not as easy. Now, there are companies that have a fairly easy time hiring workers to work in factories. And this is not a shocker. These are the companies that have pensions and healthcare plans and, you know, are a right to have your voice heard at work through a union. And they, you know, and they have apprenticeship programs, right? And so those programs are generally doing fine. And there are people who want to do them, those kinds of jobs. And so if we kind of normalize this again, it would be great rather than saying like manufacturing's a dead end or what have you. But there's a way to do this. And in fact, many firms, many regions are doing this quite successfully, but you can't bend against the laws of economics that if you're paying better wages, you're going to get more people applying for the positions. That's always been true.
And it always will be. But, you know, here's the thing. And this is the frustrating part of all this. We gave our manufacturing base away because we were sold on this idea that we're all going to be able to wear white shirts and sit in the corner office, and we're all going to still have those same good wages and benefits and job security and all that stuff. It didn't work out that way. So, you know, now we're being told, well, it can't come back because we don't want to do those jobs. And, oh, by the way, AI is going to stand in the way. So it's a fool's errand to even try. And I'm like, no, I still want things made here because I still understand in moments of crisis, we need to be able to ramp up. So the question that, and I guess this is where we end, as the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, how fast could we ramp up production of, say, ships or armaments in this country in a moment of crisis?
Yeah, well,
because here's the thing. We couldn't even get enough N95 masks. So I don't know how you're going to get warships, but I'll let you finish.
I don't have a very satisfying answer there. And in fact, it's a little bit of a terrifying one. And this is why, you know, all the naval minds, you know, in the U.S. Navy are terrified that we do not have a large commercial shipping capacity, because this is what happened in World War II. We converted facilities to build ships, right? You know, whether it was a steel mill or a commercial shipyard or something like that. And they were building ships out the wazoo, you know, like all the time, every day. We really can't do that anymore. And so this is kind of starting to rebuild that capacity. And it is going to take a while to get there. I mean, you know, if we were able to get a couple of additional shipyards back to building ships instead of just repairing them, that would represent progress. But this is a project that is, you'd see the first fruits in 4 or 5 years. You'd see more fruits in 10 years. I mean, you know, this is like the long haul. This isn't like a sugar rush political fix, but we know this can work. Because look at the incentives for the semiconductor factories. And what do we have? We have a bunch of semiconductor factories being built in the United States. Well, you know, there were going to be tariffs on pharmaceutical factories, pharmaceuticals coming from abroad. All those companies have said, we're going to build more capacity in the United States. I mean, all those, and say what you will. I mean, the pharmaceutical debate is different, obviously. But all of these manufacturers have said, we're going to build more, pharmaceutical factories in the United States of America. And so we can do this, right, with the right incentives, but it takes a rational tariff policy. It does take a tariff policy, but it's got to be a rational one. We do have to have industrial policy. Then we have to normalize the idea that it is okay to work in a factory, right? Great. Get your four-year college degree. That's actually not going to prevent you from having your job offshore. Look at all the people who studied coding who can't find a job now. Yep. They can't find a job anywhere. So, yeah. So we can do this, right? But it is going to take some hard work.
And some political will, which sadly we seem a bit short on. But we will see. Scott, as always, I appreciate the thoughts. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Likewise, Rick. And shipbuilding is bipartisan, which does give me some hope.
There you go.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks appreciate so much. It.
Our good friend Scott Paul. I want to hear your thoughts. You think we're a country that can build again? Can we manufacture? Will there be people who want to go in there and create? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that began the first strike of the Chicago Teachers Union. The strike lasted 3 days, but it won teachers a $100 per month pay raise. The school board also agreed to hire 750 more teachers to help ease the overcrowded classrooms that plagued many Chicago public schools. Some of the most important victories of the strike came for black teachers. Prior to the strike, many black educators in the city could not find full-time positions. Instead, they were relegated to a permanent substitute status. In order to teach full-time, the teachers had to pass an exam. The exam included an oral portion. Often the testers would fail black teachers who had moved to Chicago from the South. They called these teachers' Southern accents unprofessional. The oral exam became a way to bar black teachers from advancing to full-time status. In the years before the strike, black educators were organizing around this issue. They also demanded changes to the school's curriculum to better include black history and literature. These black teachers did not gain much support, even from their own union. They began to organize sit-outs to demonstrate their commitment to these changes. One result of the strike was an end to the discriminatory exam process. After the strike, the school board agreed to include more African-American content in the curriculum. The teacher strike had shown the power of the union. Over the next 20 years, CTU would stage 9 more work actions. Some lasted only 2 days. The longest was 19 days long. In 2002, the Chicago Teachers Union again went out on strike, recalling their historic fighting spirit. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So evidently we've got the big beautiful plane from Qatar. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth evidently accepted the gifted Boeing 747 for Trump to use as Air Force One. And I'm going, I don't know. I'm not there, man. The most powerful country on the planet, the wealthiest country in the history of humanity. And okay. And look, you know, this is where the interesting part of all this has been. You know, I've had some red hats. You know, he's smart. You know, we don't have to pay for it. We're going to pay for it. All right. And interestingly enough, went after the African president there, because evidently he didn't have a plane to give, but Trump would take it without question. It's really, really very sad where we are. But finally today, the one thing I wanted to make sure I hit on is, look, in this bill, as we talked about the other day with J.B. Branch, AI is coming, and in a fast way. And over the years, we've been talking about the fact that jobs are going to be lost. A study was done like 6-7 years ago that said within 20 years, half of the jobs Americans do right now will be eliminated because of AI and robotics and automation and all this. In this big, beautiful BS reconciliation bill, in this giant nightmare of a disaster, economic disaster, in this massive handout for the very well-to-do and a screw job for everyone below them, there's a little thing tucked in there, and this is what Republicans do well. And look, Democrats try, but never to this extent. They tucked in a little piece in there that the hedge fund people and the Silicon Valley tech folk going to love. Just a little thing, little tiny thing. If it's improved, if it's approved and it's there at the end, it will block any state from regulating AI for the next decade, which means Elon and the rest of the tech bros, they're going to have the opportunity to, well, steamroll states. You got OpenAI, Sam Altman, NVIDIA's Jensen Huang. Remember, they were on the plane with Trump heading over to Saudi Arabia, you know, going on that golf tour. So that they could, you know, kiss up to Trump and Republicans. And this is the payoff. This is the payoff for all that campaign cash. This is the payoff. And it's one of those things, again, that Democrats, even if they wanted to, could never have gotten through. And I've taken some flack from my redhead folks for saying that, you know, you're going to lose your gun at some point. It's just never going to be Democrats doing it. It's going to be Republicans, because Republicans do this stuff. They tell you a whole load of BS and then do the opposite. Remember the individual freedom people, the people who are like, you know, we can't have a national ID card and, you know, Social Security is bad because it's a national ID program. Then they're the ones who rammed through the Real ID Act like thieves in the night. Literally, James Sensenbrenner tucking this in like a thief in the night. And now at least the people here in Pennsylvania are rushing to get the real ID on their license because you won't be able to fly or enter a federal building soon. Yeah, Democrats couldn't have gotten that through, but Republicans did. And this AI thing, no way could Democrats, even if they wanted to, and I'm not saying that there aren't any who wouldn't, but Republicans got it through, are getting it through. And when this happens, the states who do have some mild language in place, all going to be preempted. Now, these are the people who tell you that they believe in states' rights. They believe in states' rights. And yet here, we're going to have an AI preemption, which means these tech bros, they can do whatever they want with your information, with information. Because understand, AI is going, especially in the information age, I've got college professor friends who are telling me AI right now is a nightmare for them. Because they can see who's doing their paper by going, hey, write me a paper on this. And bang, there it is. This is bad all the way around. You want to talk about a control feature? You want to talk about being able to control the masses? This is stuff that even Orwell couldn't have fathomed. This is the kind of stuff that those dystopian novels of the 30s could not have predicted, that all of us would be, you know, chat this or that, or AI this or that. Do my homework for me. Tell me what to think. Tell me how to. This is dangerous. This is dangerous stuff. And you watch the movie Idiocracy and you go, geez, they didn't need. We're heading on that path. And it's in this big BS bill. This big nightmare of a bill. It's just tucked in. Kind of like when Republicans said you can't sue vaccine companies because terrorism. I'm telling you, Democrats may want to do some things. It's always Republicans who get the horrible done. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Are you afraid of AI? Are you concerned that, well, it's going to end communication as we know it? It's going to reshape how we interact, we think, we learn. And then could it be the one thing that brings us all together to where we now all think the same way? Could this be the opioid of the masses? Want to hear your thoughts? Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program, podcast, as always. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Investigators are now looking into the background of the man they believe killed two employees of the Israeli embassy in Washington. Here's FBI Assistant Director Stephen Jensen.
We are aware of some writings that are purported to have been authored by this subject. We're actively investigating to determine both the authorship and the attribution of these writings, if they belong to this subject or not.
The man was charged with murder today. Here's Acting U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro.
Murder in the first degree for the murder of 30-year-old Yaron Levshinsky, a foreign official and official guest of the United States.
CBS's Scott McFarland says the victims, Yaron Levshinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram, were planning a life together.
Levshinsky and Milgram were a couple. The Israeli ambassador said Levshinsky had bought an engagement ring with the intention of proposing to his girlfriend next week in Jerusalem. Levshinsky recently